All right, it's March 10th, 2026, and this recording won't include a guided meditation. So, if you want a guided meditation, go to one of the other recordings. There are plenty of them around. I was thinking during that 20 minutes that time is relative. Sometimes 20 minutes can seem like a long time. Other times it can go by in a flash. And that seemed long to me, but I'm going to blame everything right now on daylight savings time. That was what caused my disruption on the golf course yesterday and everything. But anyway, so I hope people are well. We approach the solstice around our house here. This is called Birthday Week. My wife is born on International Women's Day, and I'm born on Einstein's birthday, March 14th. So there you go. We just celebrate all week, eat cake, you know. As I mentioned, I thought I would kind of take something that I've been writing, and as I look at it and I reflect on it, takes a little bit of context. This is coming out of what's known as the Anapanasati Sutta, and this is the Buddhist teachings on doing what we do, practicing mindful breathing. But it turns out that the way he thinks of it and the way he teaches it is a lot more complicated than you might think. The Anapanasati Sutta is a partner of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta, and that, meaning that it's structured in the same way, but it approaches mindfulness in a different way. Obviously, it approaches it with the breath at the center of the entire teaching. So, in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the beginning is the first foundation is the body, and the first thing that the Buddha teaches there is mindfulness of breath. And then he has a whole other variety of things that he brings in, the four elements and the postures and the corpses and parts of the body. But in the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta, he just starts with mindfulness of the breath, and it's essentially a cut and paste from, well, copy and paste, because he didn't really cut it. Copy and paste from the beginning of the Satipatthana into the beginning of the Anapanasati. So, since there are four foundations of mindfulness in this in the Anapanasati, there are four different sections there, and each of them has four steps in it. So, there's typical Buddhist teachings, all these lists, but it's four times four, so you got 16, and so each of those, instead of being called a foundation of mindfulness, is called a tetrad, which is four. Okay, that's more than enough to get you set up. So, as I say, the first section is on mindfulness of breathing, and just on breath and what we do with the breath, and it's aware of the breath, and then using the breath and breathing and being aware of the body, and then breathing and calming the energies in the body. And then the second tetrad starts, so it's on feeling tone. So in the Satipatthana, the Buddha just talks about feeling tone as being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and he just leaves it at that. In the Anapanasati, in this Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta, he goes in a different direction, which it starts by talking about very pleasant feeling tones. He doesn't talk about unpleasant at all. And so the first instruction is to, as you breathe in, be aware of, and I'm going to use the Pali word, piti. And as you breathe out, be aware of piti. And piti is traditionally, at least Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as rapture. The other people translate it as joy. It shows up, and it's kind of what I want to talk about is piti, but it shows up in different places in the teachings. So let me just read you a little bit of what I've just, this is really, rough, but get us started. Well, the first tetrad simply repeats the beginning of the first foundation of mindfulness. The second tetrad approaches feeling tone completely differently. You'll recall, I hope, that in the four foundations, that's referring because I've already written earlier about the four foundations. You'll recall that in the foundations, feeling tone only referred to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral affective sensory experiences, including the mental sense. Here, instead, the Buddha starts by pointing us to particular pleasant meditative experiences. As Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. We've just seen this term rapture, piti, as the fourth factor of awakening. So the seven factors of awakening, piti is the fourth. Here again, we're faced with understanding what is meant by rapture. Are we building toward jhana, which is the absorption states? I hope this isn't too technical, people. The absorption states, or is something else happening? The impression I get on this point from the experts, people like Ajahn Buddhadasa, Thich Nhat Hanh, and Bhikkhu Anālio, each of whom has a book on the Anapanasati Sutta, is that while mindful breathing can be the basis for jhana, that's not the thrust of this sutta. You might at some point take a side trip into the jhanas, and what a trip that would be. But the Buddha is pointing towards something else, insight. That means what's happening here is rapture short of jhana. A very pleasant, uplifting, energetic experience, but not an altered state. Here again, I will give you more of my view on piti and what it is. When I hear rapture or joy, I think of an emotion. But as I said in the seven factors section above, I believe piti is more related to the nervous system than to our psychology. Put simply, you can be a bad mood in a bad mood and still feel piti. As I'll address below in the afflictive emotions section, the Buddha doesn't talk about emotions the way modern psychology does. A key distinction is that the Buddha's teachings don't posit a self, and they aren't really interested in personal issues per se. So it makes sense that when talking about piti, the Buddha is interested not in how you feel emotionally, but energetically. In the sutta, we sense piti rather than feel it. This is tricky to talk about because it's not how modern people think of themselves. And so here we are meditating. We've connected with the breath and the body. We've calmed the body. By calming the body and the nervous system, we allow underlying energies to emerge. That's what piti is. In a sense, our ordinary consciousness and way of holding tension in our body suppresses this energy. When we let go, relax, and open, piti can come flooding up. It was quite a shock for me 30-some years ago when jolts and streams of energy started coursing through my body in meditation. I was trying to get calm and focused, and instead, I was being swept away. Piti doesn't always show up like that. In fact, for me, that form has disappeared. Mostly now, I feel a steady, upwelling flow of energy in meditation sometimes. So as you practice, just see what happens. Maybe nothing, maybe something. It's not your job to make something happen. Just observe. No doubt, though, if you keep going, especially if you keep up a regular practice and extend the length, you'll feel something. Breathe with whatever comes up. So I don't know if that's just more like, confusing than it is helpful. But it just, it points to, people often have these somewhat sort of altered states in meditation. They're like, what's going on? And I will also say people often don't have altered states in meditation, and they also say, "What's going on? Why? I heard about these altered states. When do I get those?" So it's not really our job to, judge all that and try to figure it out and make something happen or compare ourselves to something. I think that, but I do think that it's helpful because, I mean, those of you who've been with me for a while know that I don't tend to focus a lot on like the happy aspects of meditation or even life generally. I kind of, try to work with the difficult a lot. But it is really helpful in meditation to observe and notice when something pleasant is happening, however subtle that might be, whether it's a mood or a sensation in the body, an energy, an emotion, but to just notice it, and not just to notice it, but actually to bring the attention into that and breathe with that pleasant state. It's a natural thing to have pleasant experiences in meditation. Maybe doesn't happen as we want or expect it to. I think for me, I guess I feel as if there's like, you come to meditation with these expectations. Again, I'm talking about myself, but I don't think I'm unusual in this way. I come to with these expectations as I did years ago, and then that stuff doesn't happen, and I run into all these obstructions, like the five hindrances. And then I get kind of focused on like, oh, this is just a grind. I've just got to like keep doing it. But eventually, there's like some pleasant things to start to show up. Maybe the things that you were thinking were supposed to happen when you started out, but didn't happen at first. And, again, what I think happened to me was that I was so wrapped up in dealing with the difficult that I didn't know what to do with something pleasant happening. I was kind of afraid of it. And it was like, oh, I better let go of that. No, I better not get attached to that. But since then, I've learned that it's quite possible to just open to and kind of embrace the pleasant and cultivate it, and meaning sort of seeing if you can allow it to expand. And this is very subtle, right? The kind of effort. What's the difference between allowing something to expand and trying to make it expand? And the only way you can figure out the difference is to experiment. And, and meditation is a lot about experimenting and just noticing what's going on. And, oh, would it be wise for me to do this? And you spin out, you're like, okay, that wasn't the strategy. Maybe I'll try this. And it's like, oh, that kind of worked. I'm settling. So, you hear different teachings. And one of the reasons you hear different teachings is because different teachers have different experiences, and then they wind up teaching the things that that work for them, but may not work for you. It's not a one size fits all kind of practice. So you have to kind of navigate this for yourself. And since this is supposed to be related to recovery, I think it's worth bringing in the parallel to that in recovery, because just like meditation, we can't, force our recovery. Like, I really should stop this. That doesn't really work, right? I'm just going to pay attention to my breath, and I'm never going to drink again. Like, that attitude doesn't work for most people. But then it's like, but yeah, but I have to do something. And the letting go that happens with ending addictive behavior, it's like meditation, somewhat mysterious how that plays out, how that arises. And we kind of have to experiment. You know, for some people, they go to an AA meeting and they're like, this is it. I got it. Now I'm just going to hang with these people and go to these meetings and work these steps. Another person goes to an AA meeting and they're like, I can't stand this. This isn't going to work for me. And, you know, and then they go to Smart Recovery or they go to Recovery Dharma or they don't go anywhere and whatever. And, you know, we have to find our own way, what works for us. Certainly for me, as I, you know, I worked the steps for some years, and then I realized, well, this isn't working for me in this way anymore. And fortunately, I had the Dharma to, you know, turn to and, you know, started to experiment with that and thinking about, you know, turning it over to the Dharma instead of turning it over to God. And, but that was all, you know, trial and error to see if that works. I mean, I can remember one particular self-retreat sitting there, and this is in one of my books, and like sort of playing with different words for God, you know, and seeing if something would land. And something landed temporarily that I used, but it was just like, oh, saying this word and then feeling how it resonated in my body, in my mind, in my heart. And sort of the challenge, you know, I think in the spiritual world, it's not like the material world. There isn't this sort of like form that's just, it's like this, like, you know, there are, you know, I'm in a room, there's walls, there's lights, there's things, they're just, you know, things. I mean, they could be modified, I suppose. But, you know, the spiritual world doesn't have form. And so working within that means sensing and feeling and tuning in. So coming back to PT, since I started with that, PT is very much like that. It's just something that you sense. And as I said, it can arrive as just a subtle kind of flowing energy that might just not even really be that noticeable, just sort of like kind of feeling good as you're meditating, you're breathing. And then it can also arise as jolts and sudden energy moving through the chakras, and you know, that feels like the heart's blowing open. Or in the some of the commentaries, it describes it can be like showers of energy over the body. And and it can be cultivated, it can be used when it's arising. You don't have to turn away from it or let it go. You can breathe with it, just as the sutta says, breathing in, experiencing PT, breathing out, experiencing PT. You know, it's a very, it's, I think why I love this sutta particularly is this design wherein the breath is joined up with, is partnered with all these different things. The breath is partnered with the body. The breath is used for calming the body. The breath is partnered with piti, with the ple with this pleasant energy. The breath is partnered with sukha, which is the next step in this tetrad, sukha, which is a more subtle, pleasant energy. The breath is partnered with mental formations, and we breathe as we watch the mind. It's partnered with concentration, and, it, you know, and then it's partnered with insight, with what breathing in, aware of impermanence, breathing out, aware of impermanence, breathing in, aware of cessation, breathing out, aware of cessation, breathing in, aware of letting go, breathing out, aware of letting go. So it's that. It's always having this grounding thing of the breath. It's what Thich Nhat Hanh talked about in his book, Breathe, You're Alive, where he says that he practiced mindful breathing for 50 years. When he wrote that book, he says, I've been practicing mindful breathing for 50 years. And when he says that, I infer that he doesn't mean just when he was meditating, but that all the time He just tried to be mindful of his breath when he was walking, when he was brushing his teeth, when he was going to the bathroom, when he was talking, when he was silent, you know, just using the breath as a constant companion. And that balancing kind of quality that that has, that the grounding that it keeps you here in the present moment, in your body, in your felt experience. So I hope that's of some value this morning, and we have some time left if people have questions. So thank you. Here we go, Gabrielle.
Hey, Kevin.
Hi.
Hi. So, thank you so much for this talk this morning. I wasn't sure how it was going to land, but you got there for me.
Did I land it? I
Yeah.
landed the plane.
Really grateful. Lately, I've started going back to AA meetings, actually showing up in the rooms and everything rather than being on Zoom or whatever. When we moved east from California in the early 90s, it was a pretty clean slate for me because I'd never had a drink here. I didn't even know where bars were. And I had 4 or 5 years of sobriety and a really good program. So I kind of just stepped back for a long time and then my career and work and all that. But, even after all these years, 38 years this fall,
Beautiful.
There's still the need to be in the rooms. I feel it. I miss the sangha, and I'm really grateful for this group and everything. But so anyway, there is a Buddhist Recovery Network here, and it's part of the facility where they hold all the AA meetings in Bethesda, called the Del Rey Club. And so I tried that, and they have a meditation, and everything, but I hate to be this kind of a person, like they play these tapes that are like, woo, woo, the trees are blowing and put your mind on the chimes and that didn't work for me. So I'll go back to the AA and see. And then I went to that meeting and it was like, oh, God came down and spoke. So anyway, what just hit for me is your idea of the breath and what you were saying about the breath. And I never thought of it before, but why can't the breath be my higher power? Without it, I am nothing. Let's
That's
face
true.
it. And so anyway, I'm really interested in pursuing that idea and staying with my breath, and very grateful that at least I have you and this beautiful group. Thank you so much.
I love that, Gabrielle. Turn your will and your life over to the care of your
Yes.
breath. That'll pretty much take care of you. I mean, literally. Yeah, no, it's great. I think you've landed on something. I think I'm going to join you with that. I know. Just humbly ask the breath to remove my shortcomings, you know? Why not? And certainly we want to sought through conscious contact. Sought to improve our conscious contact with our breath. You know, it's definitely a good idea. So it pretty much works throughout the steps. I'll buy it. Flo, hello.
Hello. I agree. At first, I wasn't sure how the talk was going to land, but it did. Took me. I was like, "Oh, when you said when I think you said, I hope this isn't too technical." In my brain, I was like, "I'm already lost," but
Yeah.
I caught back up eventually. But my question or an observation is, I'm in the South. I'm south of Atlanta, and a lot of the meetings are similar, I think, to what Gabrielle just mentioned. A lot of the AA meetings in my area. I tried to start a recovery Dharma meeting. It didn't really take off. It was doing well before COVID, and COVID hit, and then I haven't really been able to get it back up off the ground. But I guess my question is I just celebrated 10 years, and at times like that feels like a wonderful thank you, a wonderful feat. But of course, like my sponsor's got 30, and of course my Dharma teacher has, 40 something, and I just wonder at times because I'm not actively involved in a home group like I was when I first got sober. Like I was going to my meetings, religiously, and I was, being in a service position, and then I kind of around year three, my program kind of shifted a little bit from just AA to Buddhist approach. That's when I found you. And like right now, I feel kind of like lost. I'm doing some recovery Dharma meetings online. But I sometimes feel like I'm not doing enough. Like, because I was so devout to the AA meetings in the beginning, and now I can't really find a place to land per se. And I'm just looking for experience, strength, and hope from those of you who have multiple decades versus me who just hit one. I feel like I'm sometimes fearful that I'm going to slip if I'm not actively constantly involved.
Thanks, Flo. I think it's a good question, and it's a sort of recognizable place. And I think any of us who got sober in a 12-step world, wherein we are warned repeatedly that if we stop going to meetings, we will relapse. Even as the years pile up and, that we're less involved, there can be that lingering fear, and I think it, we just have to be, I think it's good to be vigilant and to, keep sort of the 10th step of your life, of your spiritual practice, really investigating, am I kidding myself? How am I doing? What does my life look like? What do people around me think about me? What does my behavior look like? All of that, just sort of like, what's a realistic take on what's going on in my life, rather than my own, judging and doubting. But like, does it look like my life is moving in a wholesome direction? What are my mind states or my moods? Am I getting swept up in depression or anxiety? Am I having conflicts? That with the lows I love, and what my work life and all of that. It's just like, how am I doing? Am I d if I were not me and I was looking at me, what would I say about my life? Would I say that person looks like they're, kind of screwed up, or would I say, oh, they seem like a pretty together person? And so I don't know. I don't know all about the details of your life, but that's how I would look at it. I don't think that, I use the term the AA curses for some of the things that people will say, as if they know. Like, if you do this, this will happen. It's like, wow, I know that if I pull the trigger on a gun that's loaded, that it's very likely that there's going to be a shot, But to say, that's a weird metaphor, but to say, if you don't go to meetings, you're going to relapse, is just maybe, but there's a lot of people who go to meetings who relapse, so it's not a cure, I think we just have to make those judgments for ourselves.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, but nowhere in the AA literature does it say that meetings are a required part
No,
of the program.
that's right. It's very much
For
the sort of
me,
evolution of the culture that it sort of became this stuff, but you're right that in the early literature, it's Their meetings are not the be all and end all that people seem to think.
It's more the fellowship.
Right, a spiritual community and Buddhism and Sangha are part of that. You know, if you're isolating, I don't think it's healthy in any way. You know, whether, you know, it doesn't have to be AA meetings, but you know, some kind of community that's a wholesome community, I think is, you know, really important. And
Well, I'll
for some
speak
people,
like an
that can be
authority on
family.
this.
Say again.
I'll speak as though I'm an authority on this, you know, coming in at half a decade of sobriety. But, you know, for me, my interpretation of the AA literature says, you know, that the daily reprieve is contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition.
Right.
You know, so as long as the Dharma is feeding that maintenance of my spiritual condition, and like you said, I'm employing some of the tools that I picked up and put into my toolkit through the 12 steps, like the spot check inventory and stuff like that. You know, as long as I'm living a wholesome life, I feel like I'm still living those 10-step promises, safe and protected. That's just from my experience.
Yeah. Makes sense. Thank you, Michael. Charles, you got your hand up.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for
Hello?
today. I really enjoyed the little talk today. Glad I'm back. You know, this discussion has really piqued my mind about the emotional instability that I still suffer, you know, on a daily basis to some degree or another. And I really appreciate the way you taught me or put it in such concise ways of kind of like negative, positive, neutral feeling at any one moment. It's all impermanent. And also to be cautious of staying in the bliss state. And, you know, from the emotional perspective, when I go to an AA meeting a couple weeks ago, I got triggered heavily because the person recanted, and this is a guy with 40, 50 years, and he went on a rant for 5 minutes about drug smuggling through, you know, Central America. And it just triggered me so bad.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how is the secretary with 7 months, wonderful guy, by the way, you know, how's the secretary allowing this guy with 40 years to sit here and possibly trigger the hell out of people? And I never complained. Like, that's like the first time I said something to anybody. And I even, at about 5 minutes, I set off my timer, which I've never done. Like, please stop. Please stop. I'm over here going out of my skin, reliving a past that I don't even want to deal with. And, you know, I'm a super analytical person. It's just the way my mind works, and many of us too. And I can't stand when they say you, and that if you do this, you're guaranteed that. And I'm like, I've done those things, and they didn't guarantee me shit on a daily basis. Sorry for the fridge. But you know, it's that emotional stability that I seek each day. And when I kind of flounder, I try to go back to what you and other mentors and religious spiritual leaders have taught me. And they tend to be better than my old, you know, my sponsors I've had in the past, although some have been pretty incredible and pointed me to it's a disease of emotions. And how do I get out of that emotional state that's negative and depressing me, or anxious and future tripping and all that kind of stuff that we talked about? And just sitting in the breath. And I really enjoyed the person who said, you know, hey, breath's a higher power, because that is where I can always find a reprieve in the brain of triggering emotions or, you know, feelings, whatever you want to say, and just breathe. And then that's where I find that space, you know, to just be calm for a moment, for my brain to calm down. And then lately I've been doing a lot of, because I live in an amazingly spiritual spot, so I can just walk out my little cabin door and walk on sacred land and ground and watch my dog play and be completely free of any worries or cares, because I have enough. And it's just barely enough, but hopefully over this year the abundance comes. So I guess my question is kind of like, when I'm suffering those emotional states, you know, you've talked a lot about how to deal with them, but, you know, from today's perspective, how would you apply, you know, the message to, like, okay, here's a thing or two you could do to step out of that emotional state, whether it may be judging. I mean, I go to AA to practice empathy and compassion. You know, and when my mind starts to judge or do stupid things, I breathe. I breathe and I close my eyes and I pray and I meditate, right then and there. And I never could do that before. If I didn't go to AA first and then over here, Dharma recovery, refuge recovery, and all the different things I've done, I wouldn't be able to do this today.
Yeah.
Thank the creator. But anyhow, so that question was just a, you know, a takeaway today from your talk on
Yeah.
mitigating the emotions.
Yeah. Thanks, Charles. The thing I have to separate is what I'm feeling from what's actually happening. And I have, when I'm feeling bad, then I have the tendency to think that there's something wrong with me or that there's something wrong with my life. Which, it's understandable that one thinks that, but it's not always the case. Often enough, I just have a feeling, because feelings come that are difficult. And maybe it's triggered by some situation, maybe not sometimes, who knows? And I have to step back again and kind of, as I was saying to Flo, like kind of look at the bigger picture. Well, what's going on in my life right now? Like, is there some real problem that I'm, am I on some negative trajectory that's, as we're kind of talking about, like aimed towards relapse? Or am I just struggling with these underlying emotional states that tend to arise? And and as a, someone who's struggled with depression off and on, I can really catastrophize around, depressive feelings. And to somewhat answer your question, a lot of what I do is try not to catastrophize, try not to solve, try not to fix, try not to judge, try to just feel and keep moving forward in with wholesome actions. And as you're suggesting, like community, whether it's going to meetings or calling a friend, being active, getting outside, like you said, with, just like break the mood, for a minute, and then ask like, oh, is there some trend going on here? Like, I mean, last week I had like a thing, a conflict with someone, and it, set me off for several days. I was trying to solve it and trying to write an email, and rewriting the email and then deleting it and writing it again, that kind of thing. And it was very difficult. It was very disturbing. But in the midst of it, I said to myself, in a week or two, this is going to be completely gone and it's not going to matter anymore. And that's one of the ways that I kind of help myself is just to remember impermanence. Like, this is really unpleasant and disturbing, but it's not actually a, like, my life isn't going off the rails. I'm just having this one conflict in a certain area with a particular person. And it's disturbing. It's triggering a lot of feelings and all of that, but that doesn't mean anything in the larger context. And that helps me to just keep going. And, a lot of what I focus on is being normal with my wife. That for me is like a key thing. Like, no matter how I'm feeling, just try to be normal with her. And that like helps. And she has actually said to me in the last year or so, like, you seem more balanced these days, which is, with somebody who's been with me for over 30 years, it's a good sign. But like, ooh, don't want to think about what it means about the previous 29 years. But that type of thing, right? And it's basically an AA thing, which is act as if, right? I'm really upset about this one thing, but actually things are okay. So I don't have to be an asshole over here as well. I'll just, struggle a little bit over there, but try to keep acting, right? Doing the next right thing, all these cliches. Those are my, very simple responses to all of it. So we've run over as usual. I will note that for those in the Bay Area, I am going to be in person at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery tonight at 7:30. That's 2304 McKinley Street or Avenue in Berkeley, not far from Berkeley High. 7:30 to 9 with a sit and a talk. And I'll probably use the same thing I talked about today because it's easier than making up something new. So since most of you won't be there. And if you are, it'll still be different. All right. And as I mentioned, likely I won't be here next week. There may be a way in which I'm able to like be in my car or something, but there will be a gathering, and we'll figure out a way to make that happen. And
Happy birthday.
thank you, everybody. Be well. Don't drink or
Thank
use no
you.
matter
Happy
what.
birthday.
Okay, Mimi, take care.
Thank you.
All right, folks.
Much
Thank
love.
you.
And